calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Welcome back to our program, Talk Radio for all of us. How's that for you? It's exposing the con in conservative, indeed, what we do every day. And speaking of which, Ayn Rand was really one of the founders of what has come to be one of the major threads in the modern conservative movement, particularly within the Republican Party. It's gone through several metamorphoses, but Ayn Rand writing Atlas Shrugged, who is John Galder? Where is and there's noble capitalist fighting against the terrible bureaucrats and the bureaucrats making things so terrible that the railroads just said, oh, that's it, screw it, we're not going to do business anymore, and everything falls apart. And a lot of people were galvanized by that book and others similar, essays, the value of selfishness and whatnot. And so objectivist thinking still stands alone, although some folks have morphed that into libertarian thinking, and some folks like Grover Norquist and others in the Republican Party have morphed that into what they call conservative or neoconservative thinking. So going back to the source of it all, ayn rand.org, the Ayn Rand Institute, AYNRAND. Richard Ralston is with us this morning. Hey, Richard.
Good morning. How are you today?
I am great, but I'll get better. Or this afternoon on the East Coast, for that matter. And welcome to the program. Richard, you're suggesting, by the way, our quote for the day from Thomas Jefferson, when the people fear the government, you have tyranny, and when the government fears the people, you have liberty, which is something I suspect you would agree with.
Well, yes, that's a little broad. As you well know, Ayn Rand was not a fan of conservatives or libertarians either, and I enjoy occasionally talking to an intelligent liberal.
Okay, good. Well, thank you. I hope I fall into that category. You're suggesting that the only way that we're going to have health care for all Americans in the United States is if we start having health savings accounts. Am I correct in my understanding of that?
Well, that is one good step in the right direction. It is not a cure-all. That will not get health care for everybody. But it gives a break to the people who want to take responsibility, do take responsibility, and want to make their own health care decisions. It means at least as they may struggle still to pay their health care bills, but at least they're paying them from pre-tax dollars. You know, if you get it free from the government or from your employer, it's all tax-free income. But the guy who's paying for it himself has to pay his taxes first and then do it. So it levels the playing field, and it puts it in the ballpark for people.
Why not simply make medical expenses free of taxation, like home mortgages are?
That would be the best reform, so that anybody, rich, poor, in the middle, can on a tax-free basis pay their own insurance premiums or their own out-of-pocket costs.
Okay, then we get the question. Actually, this raises two questions. The first one obviously is, what about those people who can't afford to pay for their own medical care? But we'll get to that in just a second. The other question that raises is it kind of the broader question of how is this? You know, are we using tax policy to legislate? You know, with health care, you know, and we've encouraged home ownership by mortgage. I mean, is tax policy really the appropriate way to do this?
I would say no, it's not the best way, but we're working with what we've got.
So what do you think is the best way, Richard Ralston?
I would get rid of the income tax and then get other sources of income, and that would get that a bit out of the way. But the best way is to personal choice and what's called consumer-driven health care. I think there will be no control on cost unless you go to the extremes of rationing and things without people having some participation. Now, there's many things in our lives that are important, but a few of them are more important than our own life and health. I think people... It's erroneous to say people have no responsibility for any of their own health care costs. You might as well say they have no responsibility for any of their food costs or no responsibility for any of their housing costs. And, I would ask you, who does a better job at providing housing to the poor, Habitat for Humanity or the Department of Housing and Urban Development?
I think they have very different mandates.
Very different. But
and Habitat for Humanity is providing a very small amount of housing for a very small number of people.
True.
And Department of, you know, and HUD is doing it for a very large number of people, and I think both of them are doing a pretty decent job.
But if you look at, say, this, the 30-second survey of the 20th century, generally speaking, you can't look at the 20th century going by and say that across the board the government is a more efficient manager and producer than private enterprise. You know, neither fascism or communism, or in many cases very well-meaning democratic socialism, has been more efficient than the private sector.
If that's the case, then why would you want the government to provide the police department if private industry can do everything more efficiently?
Because that is the function of government, is the imposition of force to protect public safety. So private enterprise should never have the power to throw you into jail.
So why would you? I'll agree with you on that. Why would you want the government to operate the court system?
Same reason, because what the courts, by definition, the court system is the resolution of disputes between private parties.
No, okay. I've got the broad point. So you're suggesting that there is nothing that government can do more efficiently than private industry. And in fact, the private health insurance companies point out that they can deliver health care more efficiently than, for example, Medicaid or Medicare. It costs between 2 and 3% for Medicare to deliver health care in the United States. And private health insurance companies claim they can do it for 1.5% to 2.5%. And they're right. But the actual expense to us ends up to be anywhere between 12 and 25% because they have to pay dividends to their shareholders. They have to pay multi-million-dollar salaries to their CEOs. They have marketing expenses. They got the private fleet of jets for. They got to pay the lobbyists. They got to pay all these other expenses. Efficiency isn't the only thing here, Richard.
Oh, I couldn't agree more. Now, in terms of apples and apples, Medicare doesn't pay to collect its income. They graciously receive it. It's handed over by the 100,000 employees of the Internal Revenue Service, so they don't have to go out and collect premiums. Two, they don't negotiate rates. Whatever they pay is what they pay. And so that the providers either accept that rate or don't accept Medicare at all, and that results in...
Well, that's a form of negotiation. That's market negotiation. If enough providers say that they're not going to accept that rate, then Medicare is stuck not being able to provide health services to people. People yell and scream.
They do accept it, but it's the cost shifting occurs. In other words, if they don't break even on Medicare, someone else somewhere pays that.
No, if they don't break even on Medicare, they stop accepting Medicare payments. And then Medicare says, hey, we've got a problem, and they raise the payments. Well, look back at the last 30 years of Medicare. That's what's happened over and over again.
But the main thing Medicare does is they pass the administrative costs off to the providers. So, in other words, they say, here's the 130,000 pages of Medicare regulations. You figure it out. And if you get the coding wrong, you're subject to criminal prosecution.
But are not the health insurance companies saying the exact same thing, except instead of you're subject to criminal prosecution, you're subject we'll sue you, we'll take it.
That's the bargaining, the negotiated rate. But the it's difficult to compare costs because.
Well, let's bring this back to the average person because we've only got a couple minutes left here, and we're talking with Richard Ralston, ayanrand.org, the website.
Oh,
Richard,
by the way, I can give you some an HSA website as well if you like.
Go for it.
Okay, I'll give me two quickly. One word, HSAinsider.com. It's an excellent directory state by state of the insurance companies and banks that provide the accounts. And then I also do some part-time work for a nonprofit called Americans for Free Choice in Medicine. And their website is afcm.org.
Okay, so Richard Ralston, if you want us to go to health savings accounts, In this kind of pseudo-libertarian or conservative world that we have now, where I know that you're also opposed to minimum wage laws, we have a lot of people in the United States who can't even afford medical care right now. How are they going to afford a health insurance, health savings account?
The best way. I mean, many employers are picking this up now, and the employers match contributions. But.
I don't see Walmart doing that. Let's just dump the burden on the employers?
No. Well, that's an employee benefit. I think employees can
What about people who are unemployed? What about people whose jobs went to China because of the liberal trade policies, the laissez-faire trade policies that you guys advocate?
How are they eating?
Well, some of them are eating government handouts, frankly, right now.
Well, where are they living? All I'm saying is that it's an inefficient system when people, all they do is collect all the services they're asking for, and they have no responsibility or cost, is one of the things that's driving up costs. But they also, the price is they lose their own choices on their health care.
Got it. So we should all have our choices. Richard Ralston, IonRand.org. Thanks, Richard.
It's
16 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Robin Bush and his merry band ripped apart this happy land. It's Robin Hood with a switch. He steals from the poor and gives to the rich. The Bushies and the Foxies and the prehistoric limbo.
And welcome back, my friends. 21 and a half minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Welcome back. Our telephone number, 1-866-440-THOM, 1-866-440-8466. If you want to drop into our live chat room, go to TomHartman.com and click the live chat link. Our program brought to you today by Small Dog Electronics, 1-800-511-MAX, 1-800-511-MACS, or you can drop by SmallDog.com. It is the pill that will help you escape the matrix, our program. Folks in the chat room making just a whole lot of really great points. One of the folks in there saying, you know, during the dot-com boom, we were part of the middle class, you know, doing just great, and then the boom went bust, and I, you know, Bonnie says, I'm still amazed that we made it through. And that is the story of so many people in America. If we lived in a world where everybody had an income where they could save their money, and you know, save enough money to be able to pay for their health care, wouldn't it be a wonderful world? I mean, what happens if somebody gets cancer? At the average cost of cancer, $250,000 to treat cancer. Like, yeah, we're all and one in three Americans ultimately, sometime in their life, will get cancer. So, health savings accounts. I'm sorry, we're not there yet, and in terms of the average income of the average American, and we're certainly not going to get there if we continue these. Insane economic policies that have been foisted upon us by conservatives from George W. Bush, George Herbert Walker Bush, Ronald Reagan, and in terms of trade policies, Bill Clinton and the DLC Democrats, the free traders. I'm sorry, it's ripping this country apart. Uh-oh. Time for a piggy alert.
Pounds, Dr. Calculus.
Well, let me see. That would be 145 million and a half tons of the
refuse.
Yeah, refuse per every day. And by the year, let me figure, over 53 million tons of
manure?
Manure, yeah. By comparison, the pyramid of the Pharaoh Cheops weighs about 690 million tons, which means that every 4 and 3, you've got a pile of this
excrement.
Yeah.
Have you seen the bigot piggies in the starched white shed? You will find the bigot piggies stirring up the dead. Always have clean.
Yes, they always have clean shirts. Although yesterday, before the United States Senate, when the oil industry bigger piggies executives were brought in to be questioned by the senators, the Republicans were very gracious, very gracious. They didn't ask them to be sworn in. I mean, even Condoleezza Rice had to be sworn in when she testified before Congress. Remember that? The whole fight about that? Everybody's sworn in when they're testifying. Well, not the oil industry executives. And they removed the cameras from the chambers. So these guys Americans did not see them being brought in what might look like a perp walk, like the tobacco industry executives. So on top of that, this from Reuters, U.S. energy policies focus on the environment. New fuel specifications historically has hurt efforts to increase the nation's refining capacity, says Chevron Corp's CEO. Yeah, right. Well, beyond that, the price gouging, you know, there's a lot of sparring between the senators and the oil company executives. And frankly, in my opinion, it was all posturing, or the vast majority of it was posturing. But there was one question that Ron Wyden of Oregon, the Democrat from Oregon, kept pounding on, and that was price gouging. And he didn't get any kind of reasonable answer from any of the oil industry executives. So he brings the chairman of the Federal Trade Commission, Ms. Deborah Majores, forward and says, Madam Chairman of the Federal Trade Commission, the FTC, what about price gouging? You know, shouldn't you guys be doing something? Isn't this what the FTC is all about? And her response essentially, no, we should just leave that to the states. Yeah, right. You in Ohio, you take on ExxonMobil. You in Oregon, you take on Chevron. Down in Oklahoma, you folks, I'm sure you can handle Marathon Oil Company price gouging. Yeah, right. Just catch this. This is just incredible.
Whether there's a question of legality, we know for a fact that there was involvement.
Wrong clip. Here we go.
I just want the public to know you've got $2.6 billion of tax breaks. You've told me they aren't needed. I hope you'll support my effort to take them back and give that money to people who are hurting. One last question for you.
Now, that was, let's take back. This is Wyden talking to the oil executives.
You, Mr. Raymond, if I might, you've been quoted as saying that speculation accounts for about $20 of the current per barrel price of oil.
Yeah, and this is where the oil industry executives got nothing to do
now
with that.
Now, your companies have been charging record prices and getting record profits, but also getting record tax breaks. Now, the president says they aren't needed. You've just told me they aren't needed. But Congress, just a couple of months ago, gave you several billion dollars in new tax breaks. On top of the tax breaks you already
So step
got.
One, you're going to give back some of that money, guys?
Why shouldn't Congress take back the billions of dollars in brand new tax breaks that you just told me aren't needed, and use that money to help people that are hurting in our country? Mr. Raymond, your response?
I've heard that comment made many times since the passage of that legislation, and I've asked my people many times they could identify what so-called tax breaks are in that legislation.
Yeah, ExxonMobil, we don't have any tax breaks, no. Then would you give them up? No, we wouldn't give them up. 27 minutes past the hour. We'll be back with the FTC question right after this time.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
Someday soon, I don't know when, we'll see the wounded women and men lining the walls of American streets, hands out begging for something to eat.
Yes, indeed. Support the troops. Country Joe. CountryJoe.com. Welcome back, my friends. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live Wednesday, the day before Thanksgiving. Travel day for many folks. Please travel safely. And be very careful. Take good care out there. It's very often a day when a lot of people are tragically in car accidents and whatnot. We don't want that to happen to you. Tricia Erickson is with us. She's with CrisisManagementInc.com. Tricia, welcome to the program.
Hello, how are you?
I am great, but I'll get better. We've been in a technical wonderland here for the last 30 minutes, and everything is working out fine. You, on your website, talk about, first of all, Jack Murtha and should we get out of Iraq and all that sort of thing. And one of the points, one of the comments that you make on Tricia Erickson's page over at Renaissance Women, I'm quoting you now, the you I'm assuming you refer to is quote, liberals or something. You have blamed George Bush for the war. Somehow you have rationalized that the 9/11 terrorist attack just happened on TV and really did not happen in real life. The 3,000 people who jumped out of their office windows and crashed in planes, burned to death, and were crushed by tons of concrete were just acting out the scenes of a violent movie. After all, you were walking around in the sunshine, having lunch with friends, having a ride on your yacht, flying to Paris on shopping sprees, strolling your beautiful children along the lane, and life is wonderful. How dare you, President, go over to Iraq and start a war with no reason at all? This silly president who you did not vote for is just ruining your life. There were no weapons of mass destruction. Well, actually, there are, you say. There are?
Well, there always were. It was. It was known by Congress and the Senate that he always had weapons of mass destruction. And I think it's very naive of us to think that when Saddam Hussein had months and months of warning that our weapons inspectors were coming over. I mean, he's not like the most upfront, honest guy in the world. I mean, wouldn't you, if you were a dictator, get the weapons out of the country? There was a report on World Net Daily that stated that he had paid the Syrians $30 million to take the weapons of mass destruction into Syria, and that they were deposited in some of the military bases in Syria and also in Lebanon. And he had plenty of time to do it. We know his weapons of mass destruction were there. What did he do with them? Where did they go? Well, you know, he held the weapons inspectors off long enough to get them out of the country. He had $30 million to do it. That's pocket change to him. So why are we so naive? We knew he had weapons of mass destruction before, but all of a sudden we went to war with a country that had no weapons of mass destruction.
That's right, 97% of the known stockpiles of weapons of mass destruction. That Hans Blix traveled all over the country, as did Mohammed al-Baradei, and tried to find everything they could find. That when Rumsfeld said, we know the actual location, they said, fine, give it to us and we'll find it. That we pulled the weapons inspectors out and precipitously went into war, that there are hundreds, well, not hundreds, that there's close to 100 countries in the world that have things that could be called weapons of mass destruction. Couldn't you say, well, okay, let's say that for the purposes of argument, and presumably, I'm hoping you're not trying to set up an attack on Syria, that and Lebanon, that Saddam did get rid of him. Why should we attack him? He doesn't represent a threat to us. He got rid of his weapons of mass destruction.
It was a strategy to keep the war off of our soul and foil and out of tree.
What war?
What war? Okay, who do you think we're at war with?
Well, that's a really good question. When George Bush was asked this question, he was quite explicit in what he had to say. He said, and I quote, here's George Bush.
We have no evidence that Saddam Hussein was involved with September the 11th.
No. We have no evidence that Saddam Hussein was involved with November 11th. No. That was what George Bush said.
Okay, but who do you think we're really at war with?
Where?
We're at war with state, person. We are at war with an ideology that runs rampant through Syria, Lebanon, Iran, Afghanistan, Iraq, Arabia.
Are you defining this ideology as radical Islam?
Yes.
Well, Saddam Hussein was at war with radical Islam. You know, it was Osama bin Laden. The reason that he got thrown out of Saudi Arabia and lost his Saudi citizenship is because he tried to organize an invasion of Iraq to take down Saddam Hussein, because Saddam Hussein was running a secular state, and Osama bin Laden was so angry with him that he was allowing women to vote and women to wear, you know, have exposed elbows, and men to drink alcohol and to shave their faces, that Osama bin Laden wanted to take down Saddam Hussein. In fact, now we find out that the presidential daily briefing that George Bush got 10 days after 9/11, this is published in today's newspapers, said explicitly not only is there no connection between Saddam Hussein and Osama bin Laden, they hate each other.
Well, they hated each other, and then they didn't. They go back and forth.
No, I'm sorry. There was never a time when they...
Explain to me why in 2000, the year just 2000, that Osama bin Laden negotiating to spend $60 million to buy the Pearl of Allah to give to Saddam Hussein to show a solidarity of their union and ideology.
Well, first of all,
Their leaders were talking to each other all the time. You know, they turn on each other, then they're friends.
The presidential daily briefing that George Bush had before he started lying to us about an association with bin Laden
it when you call my president a liar.
Well, I'm sorry, he is a liar.
You know what? You don't have the real evidence to know that he's a liar, and that's really just slanderous And it's just disrespectful.
Here is Bush in his own words. Is he telling the truth now, or his
free world country?
Now just listen very carefully here for just a second.
You know, you're talking a lot, and you don't want to listen to me. So
Tricia Erickson, I'm just asking you to listen to George Bush.
We have no evidence that Saddam Hussein was involved with the September the 11th.
Now, was he lying or not?
Was who lying?
George Bush, when he just said that. He just said that there's no connection between Osama bin Laden and 9/11.
I couldn't hear your other guy.
I'm sorry. The other guy is the president of the United States. I'll stop talking.
I'm talking to you in the background, and I couldn't hear what he said.
Okay. Here we go. Let's just see if you can hear this.
We've had no evidence that Saddam Hussein was involved with the September the 11th.
No. Could you hear that?
Okay. Then we went to war with Afghanistan also, and we freed those people, and they got to vote, and the women are taking off their burqas.
And we should have stayed in Afghanistan.
And we should have stayed in Afghanistan, but you don't understand.
But instead, we let Osama get away and went off after Saddam.
What did you want President Bush to do after 3,000 of our people died? What would you have done had you been President Bush? You give me your genius.
I would have tracked down the guy who did it and prosecuted him, the same as Bill Clinton did when somebody killed 200-300 of our citizens in the federal building.
And what about all the other terrorists that have been bombing all over the world? I mean, what would you do with them?
Tricia, you're trying to say that Saddam Hussein somehow had something to do with 9/11. Is that what you're trying to imply?
No, you're trying to say that he didn't, and you don't know that for sure. So
I'm quoting George Bush.
You still don't.
George Bush said he had nothing to do with it.
None of us know the relationships. I know.
I'm sorry. I have George Bush's soundbite.
$60 million to show solidarity of their two nations. Okay, so. So nobody knows that for sure, and you're just flying off half-cocked, calling our president a liar when he has protected this country. He has liberated the people in Iraq.
The number of terrorist attacks around the world has increased virtually logarithmically every year since George Bush started this war in Iraq.
I'm sorry. They started way back with the U.S. coal and way before
and they,
that.
And they have been exploding.
For the last 15 years, and we ignored it, and we stayed in
our
territory.
We did not ignore it.
We acted like everything was fine until it hit our soil. Now, what do you think a president should do when 3,000 of his citizens are killed, murdered?
Tricia Erickson, if we were attacked by the Japanese at Pearl Harbor, do you think that we should have attacked Brazil?
Every president that's gone to war has attacked a different state than the state that they were warring with. It's a strategy.
Give me one example, please.
You go back through your history.
Okay.
All right. George Bush went.
Let's look. In 1898, you had the Spanish-American War. We said that the USS Maine was blown up in the Philippines, and we went to war against the Philippines, the Spanish and the Philippines. In World War II, we were attacked by the Japanese. We declared war against the Japanese. The Germans then declared war against us because they were allies of the Japanese, and so we had to fight the Germans as well.
But there are many wars where presidents went to another state besides the war itself. Okay, why did Clinton go to Bosnia? George Bush.
Well, that's a good question. I don't have an answer to that. I don't know the answer. I'm not here to defend Bill Clinton. I think Bill Clinton did a lot of stupid things. But the point is that's got nothing to do with the fact that today we have people dying in Iraq for no reason, for a lie. So the Bush could get political.
In Iraq? How many Kurds died in Iraq with Saddam Hussein gassed them? 180,000.
How many people are dying in Darfur? Four right now. We're doing nothing to help them.
Let me tell you something. We are a brother's keeper. We can
then let's go into Darfur.
We can sit in our houses.
Let's go into Zimbabwe.
People in Iraq, all right? Those people, the mothers are thanking the soldiers that their daughters aren't being dragged out of their homes right now and raped and never seen them again and maimed, and that their aunts and uncles aren't being killed and their hands and feet aren't being cut off.
But it's happening in Darfur. It's happening. It's happening in Africa. We're doing absolutely nothing. They just don't happen to have any oil.
Yeah, why don't you go over and do something about it? Then at least President Bush is doing something.
He's blowing up the Middle East.
He is liberating a country that lived under tyranny. It was a strategy to draw the tyranny off of us.
Make our soldiers bait.
Take them over into Iraq to fight the war there to save his own country and to liberate Iraq at the same time.
Okay, Tricia Erickson, it's been great talking with you. You give as good as you get. I really appreciate it. CrisisManagementInc.com, the website. Tricia Erickson, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
It's 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
If you're out of a job and your pension's been robbed, well, it's no act of God. You've been bushwhacked. And if you work 40 plus, but you're still going bust because your rent's going up, you've been bushwhacked.
Yes. Been bushwhacked. Welcome back, my friends. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. A few of the folks in the chat room, you know, why have an argument with somebody who, you know, doesn't get it, doesn't seem to want to get it? Well, the point is that I think all of us, this is, you know, I say here we are winning, helping you win the water cooler wars with uncommon sense and the radical middle. And I think it's really important that people have some sort of a positive model for how to discuss. Whether they're people that we work with, people that we meet, whether family members. This is not a discussion you may want to absolutely mimic over the Thanksgiving table, but it's a starting. I mean, my goal in these conversations is to not only illuminate the talking points of the right and give you some rational response to them, but also hopefully to model the process of debate that doesn't involve the Bill O'Reilly technique of, you know, shut his mic off, you know, that kind of thing. And there's not blood on the floor when you're all done. So, anyhow. 1-866-440-THOM, our telephone number. Tony in Yucaipa?
Hi. Yeah, Yucaipa.
Yucaipa, California. Hey, Tony, welcome to the program.
Yeah, hi. I just think that this conversation you just had with Ms. Erickson is actually typical of conversations that you might have with a lot of conservatives. You get to a point in the argument where their best defense of their argument is, you don't know, you don't really know. And based on that premise, we don't know if Hugo Chavez might not have been involved in 9/11 either. Perhaps, I mean, he didn't like us, you know. So maybe,
well, we don't know if Tony Blair might have been.
Pardon me?
We don't know if Tony Blair might have been. Maybe Arnold Schwarzenegger was. Maybe we should invade California.
Well, if you get Arnold out of here, I wouldn't mind. But I think, you know, that's the point you get into on a lot of subjects.
I know. It becomes an article of faith.
I've had that argument with people on creationism. They get to the point where they say, you don't really know, do you?
Yeah.
So why not teach it in the schools?
Right. Yeah. And you know, my position on creationism is I think it should be taught in the schools as part of comparative religion classes. People should learn the foundational myths of Buddhism, of Hinduism, of the various foundational, you know, creation myths of Christianity and Judaism, Islam, all the major religions. People should understand their creation myths.
Sure.
But yeah,
that's,
I think
not where they want it, though.
Yeah, no, it's not. But good point, Tony, and thank you for making it. And I hope you have a wonderful Thanksgiving tomorrow.
And to you.
Take good care. Yeah, this is really where it very often just kind of boils down to is it's, you know, my belief versus your belief. And when it gets to that point, that's when you just have to say, you know, okay, you know, we're going to have to agree to disagree. Dan in Sicklerville, New Jersey. Hey, Dan, welcome to the program.
Hey, how's it going, Tom? Nice to have you. I guess my point is probably just reiterating the last caller's point. That conversation was just bizarre to me. I thought at one point she was going to start with the weapons were buried in the Baca Valley, and she knows it.
Yeah, well,
some Bible code or something.
Yeah, but the reality is, you know, a lot of our listeners are going to be over the holidays encountering folks who have these exact same beliefs. And
the thing is, there's really no way to counter. I mean, the argument, you don't know, like last caller said. I mean,
yeah.
We don't know if France is going to attack us tomorrow. We don't know if Germany is not going to attack us tomorrow.
Well, that's where they start pulling this stuff out of the hat about, you know, we've liberated all these people and we're saving their lives. And, you know, Saddam was a horrible tyrant. And you have to say, yeah, Saddam was a horrible tyrant, but he's nothing compared to Robert Mugabe. Robert Mugabe is in the process right now as we speak of starving to death 2 million people in Zimbabwe. We're doing absolutely nothing about it. He's nothing compared to what's going on in the Sudan. And you've got you know, the former president of the United States saying, you've got Colin Powell saying, please do something about Sudan.
Yeah.
And George Bush is like, there's no oil there.
Sitting on their hands, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, but the thing is, I don't think there's any way to win an argument with someone like that or to get your point across, not necessarily to win the argument, but at least get your point across for them to grasp where you're coming from. I think they're so stuck in the mode of thinking that this is the way it was.
Well, yes and no, Dan. My experience is that when I'm having an argument like that with somebody whose job it is to have that argument, basically. I mean, Trisha's putting herself out there as somebody who will argue positions on the right. There's no way she's going to say, yeah, you made a good point. She's not going to do it. But in real life, I've had that discussion with a lot of people, and, you know, they hit that point where they've just exhausted their talking points, and they realize that they got nothing left, and they go, hey, wait a minute, maybe I should be thinking about something. And there's that little crack in reality that, you know, starts to crack open for them.
I think I might have been under the wrong impression. I thought she was just a regular caller in.
No. She's
part of the orchestrated echo chamber.
That's right. She is a guest available to be on right-wing talk show hosts, and she's been on right-wing shows right now. One of the right-wing booking agencies is promoting her, and she'll probably be on a whole bunch of local shows all over the country over the next few days, and those are going to be her talking points. And by and large, the people, she had no idea that she's coming on a liberal show, I don't think. And, you know, most of the people are going to say, yeah, you're right. And, you know, so I thought it was important to say, hey, you know, I've got a challenge for this. Dan, thanks for the call.
Right,
good to hear from you. I appreciate
you.
It. Mike in Sarasota, Florida. Hey, Mike, what's on your mind?
I have a very interesting concept that I don't think anyone's ever considered.
Okay. We have one minute, Dan. Mike, excuse me.
Okay, it doesn't appear that we're ever going to change conservatives' minds. We are not going to go onto their side, and since they've rigged the election so that we can't possibly win anymore, let's partition the country. And our side will have universal health care, we'll have mandatory unions for companies like Walmart, and the other side, they can attack anyone they want, eliminate all taxes, and, you know, fix the elections.
Yeah, if only it were that simple. Yeah, you know, in theory it is. We tried that in the 1850s, the 1860s, and it didn't work very well, Mike.
Well,
but I realize you're being facetious.
I think the concept was based on a pretty different thing. Slavery and freedom, I think, are two completely.
Well, how is slavery? I mean, qualitatively, obviously, there's a huge difference between the kind of slavery we had in the 19th century and people working at Walmart. But conceptually, I think that there's still a lot of the same arguments that are being played out. But in any case, good point, a good rhetorical point. The reality, though, Mike, is that, and thank you for the call, is that even the reddest of red states still have large percentages of blue folks, you know, folks who believe in progressive values and believe in the, you know, protecting the working person and believe in a clean environment and believe in the United States minding its own business, which, oddly enough, during World War II was the Republican argument. It was the Republicans who didn't want to get us into World War II. You know, that Hitler guy, he's just fine. Just leave him alone. And so, anyway, we'll see. Have a great Thanksgiving. We'll be back. It's 57 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
Yes, and every time Rush Limbaugh hears that music, he ups his meds. Welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you the day before Thanksgiving. Hope you're having happy and good reunions with family and friends or on the way to same. And if so, that you're traveling safely and taking it easy. Thea Lee is with us with the AFL-CIO. She's the policy director for the AFL-CIO. Thea, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Tom. Glad to be here.
Glad to have you on. I wanted to talk with you about trade situations, international trade agreements, and labor provisions thereof. And I suspect that I'm going to both agree and disagree with you on this. And so let's just try and get this all out. First of all, CAFTA, NAFTA, WTO, there are no functional trade provisions in any of these agreements, right? No functional labor protections in any of these trade agreements.
Well, there are weak labor provisions in most of the free trade agreements. The WTO has virtually no labor protections at all. But we do have labor provisions in some of our what we call the unilateral trade programs with the developing countries. And so we've actually been using some of those labor provisions for about 20 years now.
And what's the AFL-CIO's position on this?
We'd like to strengthen the worker rights protections in all of our trade agreements, and we will oppose any trade agreement that doesn't have enforceable protections for what we call the core workers' rights. Those are the rights that the International Labor Organization, all the countries of the world essentially, have come together and agreed that those are the fundamental human rights that every worker in the world deserves.
And those rights are?
They are freedom of association and the right to organize and bargain collectively, and prohibitions on child labor, forced labor, and discrimination in employment.
Well, it seems that, at least with regard to the first, we're here in the United States in violation of this.
We are in violation, and that's one of the reasons we push so hard to have these worker rights protections in trade agreements. Two things. One is that we welcome and encourage countries like Australia or Canada or Mexico to bring workers' rights cases against the United States. We'd like to challenge our own government to live up to our international obligations, particularly on freedom of association. And the other reason is just we have a general sense that if we can't protect our rights here, if American workers are constantly threatened with losing their jobs if they stand up for themselves and form a union, then you know workers in other parts of the world, in China, in Bangladesh, are going to be even more vulnerable, and that we need to come together, workers all over the world really need to come together and say, enough already. We're happy to be part of the global economy, but we don't want to be part of a global economy where profits are made on the backs of workers who are denied their basic rights.
Yeah, now, which brings me to the area where I have some confusion around this. And speaking, by the way, as an outspoken supporter of labor and a member of two unions that are AFL-CIO affiliated myself, it seems to me that there's a disconnect between arguing on the one hand that we should have trade agreements with labor protections, and on the other hand that we want to protect employment. We want to protect the rights of workers in any one particular country, specifically the United States, since that's where we happen to live. For example, how does it help us here in the United States if GM is going to make cars in Mexico, for example, and instead of paying, you know, 50 cents an hour, they get a labor union in there, and now they have to pay $2 an hour? I have no idea what the numbers are for Mexico, but I know that they're a lot less than here. Or Burma, you know, or China, or whatever. You know, how does that help us? I'm all in favor of international labor rights, mm-hmm. but shouldn't we be instead saying we don't want any free trade agreements? We want to go back to a system of tariffs which kept domestic industries domestic.
Well, I think it's too late to go back, frankly. And
why?
Because we're, I mean, what we can do, I mean, and here's the point. The point is that I agree with you. We need to stand up for good jobs here in the United States, and we need to say no to trade agreements that are going to erode our ability to create good jobs here in the United States. What we're trying to do is figure out a way of coming up with a set of principles for the global economy that work for workers everywhere, that we don't want to turn our backs on Mexican workers or Chinese workers. What we want to do is empower them and protect their rights. And we think that if we lived in a global economy where every worker could exercise his or her rights, and they could form unions, they could stand up for themselves, they could have a political voice as well as a voice at the workplace, that we could benefit from trade. It's not trade that's hurting us. It's the wrong kind of trade that is hurting us. It's trade that's exploitive, that where all the benefits go to a multinational corporate elite. It's not the fact that we send goods across the border that is undermining our living standards. It's the fact that companies can roam the world looking for the weakest and most vulnerable workers and the most craven governments, and reward those governments with foreign investment.
Well, I agree that there's a lot of truth to what you just said, but it really goes beyond that, though. I mean, countries have national economies based on a whole variety of things, their commitment to local infrastructure, national infrastructure, things like education, roads, whatnot, their natural resource base, their population-to-resource ratio.
Mm-hmm.
When Adam Smith wrote The Wealth of Nations back in 1776, he laid out this thing of, you know, you've got three countries. One makes wool because of the geography. They grow sheep easily, or sheep live well there. Another country makes cheese and milk products, and another country makes wine. And none of the three can make all three. Each country can only make one well. So if they all trade with each other, everybody gets cheese, wine, and a sweater to wear. And isn't that nice? But, he pointed out, and Ricardo actually amplified on this, although conservatives twist his arguments around to refute them, the argument of, you know, comparative advantage, that if two of those countries are both making wool, then it might make sense for them not to trade with each other. And that historically, the way that from the founding of this country in 1787, when Tench Cox, who was never a member of Congress, but started the first Chamber of Commerce in the United States, when he lobbied essentially for the passage of the first tariff in the United States that specifically said in the legislation for the protection of domestic industries. From 1787, when Tench Cox got that through Congress, right up through Reagan, when Reagan started dismantling these agreements, and then Bush, and then Clinton, and then Bush, But up until that point of Reagan, we became the industrial powerhouse of the world in large part by doing what China and Japan are doing right now, which is saying, you know, we're not going to let products into this country in, without a tax on them, a tariff on them, if they if they're coming in and competing with our domestic industries. If it costs a dollar's worth of labor to make a pair of shoes in the United States, and you can make them in Burma for 10 cents worth of labor, that's fine. You can make them there, but you're going to have to pay a 90-cent tax when you bring them into the United States. I mean, why not just go back to that? It's tried and true.
Well, one of the things we need, I mean, first of all, I want to make clear that worker rights isn't the only thing we need to do in trade policy. We also need to have, we need to be able to use our trade laws around dumping, around subsidies, around
sure.
import surges effectively. So countries need more flexibility, more policy space. They need to be able to put in place, for example, an industrial policy. And a lot of the trade rules that we have now prevent us from taking common sense measures to create strong jobs and strong communities here in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, our critique of the trade agenda goes way beyond workers' rights. That's simply one piece that we focus on because it's an important piece. It's something where we have a lot of unity with workers around the world. But it's not to say it's the only thing we need to do. We also need to get our currency better aligned. And that would actually really, really help American workers. If the American dollar right now is way overvalued, and it makes it very difficult for producers on American soil and workers to be competitive in the global
right, but,
economy.
Right, but still, if Chinese labor, even if it got unionized, you know, if Chinese labor is at 50 cents an hour right now and they could have a good standard of living at a dollar an hour, and so, you know, and then the Chinese currency was doubled in its value to the yuan to the dollar, which nobody thinks is going to happen. But it doubled. We'd still be competing, you know, U.S. workers, $15, $20 an hour workers, would still be competing with $2 an hour labor.
There's always going to be differences in prices and differences in wages across countries. There's also transportation costs. There's also a lot of other considerations about where jobs go. And our view is that if we had a fair set of rules and we had a government that actually looked out for the interests of American workers instead of corporate profits, that we could, in fact, have a trading situation. One thing is, you know, if Chinese workers earn more, and had a democracy and had rights, they would build a strong middle class. That would be a tremendous market for American products.
Yeah, I don't disagree.
We don't have a reciprocal trade relationship right now because our whole trade policy is built around the idea that we consume and they produce.
Right.
And so the companies have made a tremendous amount of money from beating down wages and working conditions for workers all around the world and then bringing stuff back here and selling it for very high prices to American consumers. The result is, you know, we're going into debt to the rest of the world at a tremendous and really scary rate.
Yeah, $1 billion a day.
$2 billion.
$2 billion a day. $1 billion a day to China.
Right, and
yeah.
It's more than $1 million a minute is how much more we are importing than we are exporting. That's, you know, 60 minutes an hour, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
Right, and it could all be made here in the United States. Okay, good talking with you. Thea Lee, who is the policy director for the AFL-CIO. More information, AFL-CIO.org. Thea, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom. Bye-bye.
It's been a great conversation. It's 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, a place where our talking points come from Madison and Jefferson, not some right-wing think tank.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I wouldn't screw up the environment or the money for retirement like the liberals complain. I'd impress all my poo-pooers, shocking all the evildoers if I only had a brain.
Yes, indeed. Welcome back, my friends. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Just to kind of wrap up the conversation of the last hour, I have to say I am concerned that that some of our labor unions want to be international or are international, and you know, in their haste to have a large international membership, which I think is a good thing, are arguing for trade policies that might, you know, give them a little more leverage. Again, I think that's a fine thing, and in fact, I encourage that. But that don't necessarily help American jobs and Americans, and that's my first priority. I, you know, call me a a nationalist or whatever you want to say. I wouldn't use that word to describe myself, but in any case, it's I really think that, you know, we need to be each country should be looking at its own needs in terms of trade policy first and foremost. And so, anyhow, enough said. Victoria Jones with us with the Talk Radio News Service. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom. Well, very interesting. The big story in Washington, D.C. today is just not a political story, although it has the potential to be political. It's this massive tractor trailer that burst into flames, exploded on I-95.
Whoa.
And, I-95
I didn't know about
north of the Beltway.
And it was hopefully not carrying a toxic cargo.
No, it was carrying fuel.
Oh, my.
Are
people around okay? I mean, is this... inform me here. I don't know anything about this, Victoria.
Well,
I'm sorry.
Well, this happened very early, just before 6 o'clock. The driver thought he saw some flames and had the good sense to get out.
Mm.
So he's alive. Everybody else is alive.
Good.
Good. Before it exploded, the drivers who were backed up at that point, everybody had to get out of their cars and run. Mm. They all ran away from it before it exploded, so nobody actually has been killed.
Good.
But, of course, the I-95, which, as you know, is the major corridor north-south from Maine all the way down to Florida and linked through the Beltway. So anybody going to any airports, everybody traveling today was stuck for hours and hours and hours.
Oh, my. Yeah, in fact, Alex, our board op in New York, says it was reported in the news at the top of the hour. I just have been – it's been one of those crazy days, and I haven't been able to listen to my own newscasts. Oh, my. Well, that's remarkable. You know, Dee Dee Miller, Cindy Sheehan's sister, was just arrested about an hour ago. Is this going to have any echoes in Washington, D.C.?
Yes, I think it will do. I think there's going to be less sympathy for Cindy Sheehan than there was in August. I think there's a little bit of a sense that she's a grandstander, so I don't think she'll get as much sympathy. But I do think the fact that McClellan County, the county in which the ranch is, which is, seems to have been taking these steps to make free speech restrictive in that area, is going to come in for some criticism. But again, you know, the president will, I think, have attention drawn to the war at a time when he'd like it to be quiet. Congress is gone. People aren't talking about what Jack Murtha said anymore. And once again, they'll start focusing on the war this weekend.
It seems like, you know, attaching the word grandstander to somebody who is out there trying to get publicity for their cause is almost, I mean, Cindy Sheehan should be grandstanding, shouldn't she? I mean, why, you know, by definition, why would that be a bad thing?
Well, I think more than anything else, because the word grandstander
is a negative.
It's a negative word. Exactly. I mean, you're absolutely right. What is she going to do? She has a cause. She wants people
to a pejorative meme that the Republicans have trotted out to try and slap on her?
They've tried, as you know, many things. They've tried to turn her into the loony left. They tried to say that she's not honoring the memory of her son and that her son and she disagreed. But mostly they've tried to portray her as a bit of a nutcase. So I don't think the grandstanding is going to cut it any more than anything else, because at this point it isn't, as you know, about Cindy Sheehan. It's about the majority of Americans.
Yeah, yeah. And it really is absolutely that. I mean, the new surveys are just absolutely startling. You know, some... what was it here? Hang on just a second. 64% of Americans now believe the Bush administration, quote, generally misleads the American public on current issues to achieve its own ends, end quote. 64% of Americans?
That's astonishing.
It really
That's
is.
Astonishing. That they generally mislead, like a routine thing?
Yeah, this is in the Wall Street Journal today. A majority of U.S. adults, I'm reading from the Wall Street Journal online, a majority of U.S. adults believe the Bush administration generally misleads the public on current issues, while fewer than a third of Americans believe the information provided by the administration is generally active, the latest Harris Interactive poll finds.
So I suppose then the interesting question will the electorate act on that?
Yeah, and then when asked about former Vice President and Chief of Staff Scooter Lewis Libby, who's been indicted on charges of perjury, blah, 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 more than half of U.S. adults say the situation indicates a larger problem in the Bush administration. Only 35% say it's an isolated incident.
Whoa!
Yeah, yeah, I mean, this stuff is picking up some traction here. So, anyhow, you're going to have a nice vacation. You're going to be gone tomorrow and the next day, Victoria?
We're going to be gone tomorrow and the next day, yes. So I'm cooking today and eating tomorrow.
Okay. Well, I'll be here live, so just for our listeners. And I hope you have a wonderful Thanksgiving. And your efforts down in Louisiana are ongoing.
They are ongoing. Ellen was down there earlier this week. She's back now. But the Talk Radio News Service continues to try and do some work down there.
Her picture is on the cover of Talkers Magazine this month.
Absolutely.
It's great. TalkRadioNews.com, by the way, where you can find out more information about that. Victoria Jones, thanks a lot for talking
with
us.
Thank you.
Good talking with you. Have a great Thanksgiving. It's Tom Hartman, the Tom Hartman Radio Program, the place where smart people get their news, 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Yeah, we need some shelter from this bunch. Oh, man. A majority of U.S. adults believe the Bush administration generally misleads the public on current issues, writes the Wall Street Journal today. Welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Our number 1-866-440-THOM. That's 1-866-440-8466. Our chat room, you can get to live chat room by going to tomhartman.com. You can also drop into our message board there and participate in the conversation if you'd like. An email, I got actually several emails as a result of on Tuesday at the end of the show, as the show is wrapping, saying, and, please patronize the companies that advertise on our program. And they all were saying essentially the same thing. Here's one. This is from Sharon in Washington. She said, you said on your show Tuesday that we should patronize companies that advertise on our local progressive radio stations. And then she says, my station's running ads for Sam's Club during your showtime. Certainly you can't encourage us to support Walmart and Sam's Clubs. Well, actually, let me give you my take on this. First of all, while I personally would not buy something at a Walmart or a Sam's Club because I don't think that their labor policies are appropriate, and I don't like what they're doing to America, I acknowledge that what they are doing is legal. If we want to change the game, we have to change the rules of the game. And business is nothing more than a game, and it does have rules, and we the people define those rules. And so I think that, we need to be aggressively out there working to change the rules. One of the reasons why, again, I'd say, I personally wouldn't shop at a business that I couldn't support ethically, and yet at the same time I'm not going to support a boycott of such businesses, is because boycotts very often, encourage the mentality of, oh, we should vote with our dollars. And if you pursue that mentality to its logical end, it leads to the thinking that those people with the most dollars should have the most votes, which is a variation on the problem that got us here in the first place. I'd also say, with regard to advertisers that I might not personally support, I would remind you of Vladimir Lenin's comment. Not that I'm a big fan of Lenin. But in any case, of Vladimir Lenin's comment that the definition of a capitalist is somebody who will sell you the rope with which you are going to hang them. Sharon goes on to say it's bad enough the drug companies are advertising, at what point do you take a stand, blah, blah, blah. When is prostitution no longer acceptable? Well, this is a commercial world, and this is a commercial radio station, a commercial radio program and commercial radio stations, and it's how we pay the bills. And so what I would suggest is that those companies that, you hear advertising, any company that wants to advertise is probably going to be on the air in a local station. These are generally local buys. We're not carrying those ads on the network, but I'm not sure that we couldn't. The point is that the companies that are overtly progressive, those companies that are coming out and saying, we really want to reach a progressive audience. We want to talk to people like the Organic Wine Company or Small Dog Electronics, where they're specifically saying, we feel some affinity for what you're doing. Though, and local advertisers in particular who are advertising on our local affiliates. I just, really want to strongly encourage you to support and endorse, support those companies and let them know that you're there because they're advertising on the program. Ricardo in New York, 1-866-440-THOM. Hey, Ricardo, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. I wanted to make a couple of comments on, I believe Patricia was your first guest, on her falling back on the war apologist reasoning that we are in Iraq so that we don't have to fight them over here. There are a number of reasons why it's completely ridiculous.
The flypaper argument.
The flypaper argument. First of all, if terrorists are out to hurt Americans on American soil, as they claim they are out to, why would us sending our army to Iraq lure terrorists there? Why would they want to fight our army when they could still come here and bomb us and hurt us here? And furthermore, does she really believe that if there were terrorists who were hiding out in the United States, that the minute we invaded Iraq, that they would pick up, go to the airport, hop on a plane, and go to Iraq to fight the Marines?
Yeah,
that makes no sense at all.
Right. It's a fundamentally nonsensical argument. And in fact, the antithesis is the case, and that is that by putting our Marines there, what we are doing is providing them with the very best kind of battle training.
Sure. And also it makes us more vulnerable here, because if the theory is that, you know, a state-sponsored actor would want to attack us, then we should take it to the states that really do want to attack us. Iraq, there was no reason that they would attack us. Secondly, it's also profoundly immoral to put the burden of our problem on an unwitting populace in Iraq. It's like if New York City wanted to deal with our drug problem, if we sent all the crack to Newark, New Jersey.
Right.
You know, it makes no sense, and it's immoral.
Yep. Well said, Ricardo. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
For sharing that. Good to hear from you. John in Seattle, Washington, you're live and on the air.
Yes. The thing I wanted to talk about is that this is a battle of religious philosophy or ideology.
Well, I think that was Trisha's point. She was suggesting that the whole point of the battle was that we were fighting against radical Islam. And my rebuttal to that is that so is Saddam Hussein. Saddam Hussein was fighting against radical Islam. In fact, that's one of the reasons why we put him into power in Iraq and why we supported him for an entire generation.
Yes, and the other thing is that if we do not counter the idea that if some of them blow themselves up, they go to heaven, we have to counter that. If we don't, we're never going to win.
Well, yes and no. I agree with you that the idea has to be countered. I don't think that we can do it. That would be like an imam in Iran standing up and saying, you know, Catholics have to change their policy on birth control. And the Catholics are going to go, who are you to tell us? You know, when we hear it from the Pope, we'll listen to you. And so I think that, you know, if we're going to encourage change within Islam, first of all, we're going to have a very hard time doing it. But the simple way to do it is to encourage those elements within Islam with whom we agree, to give them a bigger microphone and more exposure. And you don't do that by starting a war in their own backyard. This is why Hosni Mubarak, who is essentially a secularist, I mean, he's a Muslim, but he's running a secular state, Egypt, said, you know, begged George Bush not to invade Iraq. He said, if you invade Iraq, you're going to create 1,000 bin Ladens.
And, of course, the other thing is, if they wanted to go to war, they went to war because they wanted to. Why did they go to war with a shortage of the amount of equipment that they went with?
Yeah, well, it's because these guys really and truly believed that they were going to have, a two-week war and it was going to be all over. It's really clear that they believed their own PR. And the reason that they believed it is because they thought that they were so smart that they didn't want to listen to anybody else, including the military, including Colin Powell, including their own generals who were saying no. And Shinseki says, you know, we're going to need a lot more, you know, they tossed him out on his butt. I mean, you know, so it's a disaster and a travesty. But, John, thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. Sarah in Vienna, Virginia. Hey, Sarah, welcome to the program.
Hi. I saw something recently. I was wondering if you had run across. It's about the CDC proposing a new rule that would make it easier to quarantine people.
Right. Yeah, and not just a new rule. There's a whole set of new rules that would, in the event of the bird flu, make it easier to quarantine people and also to keep track of people as they travel.
Both. They want to be able to quarantine them, but they also want to take information like your phone number and email address in case you sit by someone who's infected.
Right, right.
And it just strikes me as like, it seems like a net is closing.
I don't disagree with you, Sarah. It concerns me. And this is the problem that I have with this isn't so much that they're doing it, but that they're doing it without any debate. That, you know,
yeah.
It may be appropriate that in a time of a national emergency, when there's a disease floating around that literally could kill, you know, millions of Americans, that we may say, okay, for the period of the time that this disease is running around loose, we're going to change the way that we operate as a society. We're actually going to give up some liberties, for example, over a short-term purpose in order to protect society. I mean, that's what a quarantine is all about, and most governments actually have the power to do that anyway. But you just simply declare an emergency. But what's happening right now is the Bush administration is trying to make these part of the long-term, ongoing, all the time, with or without an emergency law of the United States of America.
Right.
And it's being done without a healthy debate in Congress, the same way the Patriot Act was passed. And the Patriot Act was passed on the heels of the hysteria created by the anthrax attacks, which are still, you know, unsolved and undiscussed to this day. The anthrax that showed up in the offices of the only two members of the United States Senate who could have stopped the Patriot Act, Pat Leahy, who was in charge of the Senate Judiciary Committee that it had to go through, and Tom Daschle, the leader of the Senate Democrats, who could have stopped it at the floor. The only two guys who got the anthrax, and, you know, that panic got us the Patriot Act, and I'm just concerned about what a bird flu panic might bring us. And so I don't disagree with you, Sarah. I think, though, that we need to have a healthy debate on these topics.
Oh, definitely.
So,
I'm just waiting for the day that we hear that the borders are being closed for our own protection.
Yeah. Well, it'll go much farther than that. It'll be, you know, Cleveland is being locked down for your own protection. But if you look back at what happened with SARS, for example, in Toronto, we were living in Vermont at the time, and there was a SARS case in Vermont, in Burlington, Vermont, and there was SARS in Toronto, and the government of Canada and the government of Vermont essentially locked down, you know, those hospitals. And, you know, they were restricting civil liberties. And everybody agreed, this is a good idea. We don't want SARS to get out into the general population. But then as soon as the emergency was over, the emergency was over and we went back to normal. And that seems like a more rational way to do it. And it didn't require any legislation to do that, by the way, in either country. Sarah, thanks a lot for the call and for raising this issue. It is an important issue and one that hopefully we'll have an opportunity to discuss at more length as the days and weeks go on. It's 45 minutes past the hour. Tom.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. 9 minutes before the hour, a place where reason is our lifestyle choice. Viagra for your brain, the Tom Hartman radio program. And it's great. Alex and David and everybody's figuring out, every now and then Tom needs a little help here. Turn off your speakers. We're coming back on the air. I love it. Thank you. Welcome back to our program. Our number 404. It's 866-440-8466. 440-THOM. Drop into our live chat room, TomHartman.com, if you would like. It's the day before Thanksgiving. We will be live tomorrow on Thanksgiving, and we will be live on Friday, by the way. We'll all be here. Dan and Alex in New York and David and I here and Louise, and we'll be doing a live program for you. So it should be a lot of fun. So tune in, say hi, and all that sort of thing. Jerry in St. Louis, Missouri is on the air, on the line. Jerry, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hello.
Jerry?
I'm assuming you're Jerry.
Yeah, okay.
I'm Tom.
I want to make sure. Listen, I have something to be thankful for.
Okay.
In this time of somewhat gloom. When I was a kid in the 50s, watched all those science fiction movies. And I was also surrounded by, you know, heavy racism. And as a kid, I got this idea that if blacks and whites intermarried, they would produce a life form that in some future plague would be the only one that survived. And as I went on to be a science student, so I was thinking scientifically. But anyway, it occurred to me the plague has arrived, and isn't it wonderfully poetic that the children of slavery are the ones that we see now defending democracy for all of us.
How you mean? I'm missing the.
Well, if you look on television,
the metaphor.
Who are the Congress people that are the most vociferous at defending democracy?
Oh, the Congressional Black Caucus.
Right.
Yeah. Okay.
And isn't it interesting that they are the ones that we put our faith in, Representative Conyers, Walters.
Yeah, yeah, you're right. Waters. We have come a long way since you and I were children, and yeah. And thank God for it.
Yeah, but I just thought it was interesting that my childhood thoughts that actually the black influence on the culture was going to save us, and it just dawned on me the other day, you know, it's happening.
Yeah, and it doesn't need to be biological. It can be. It's the idea of memes being contagious, thought viruses, just the whole idea of liberty. Jerry,
I didn't mean there was any genetic.
Yeah, no, I got it. Yeah. At first, I wasn't sure where you were going with that. And I was
fiction movies, you know, of course, I was thinking of how all this would work at the biological level because there were monsters and all that stuff, you know.
Yeah. But what's happened really is that, you know, we have in this country, and this is where I have a lot of hope for this country, even in the face of the rise of incipient fascism. We have in this country a 230-year history of democratic ideals, even though we haven't always lived up to them, even though we had slavery, even though women couldn't vote. I mean, all these, the problems that we had, we were still radically ahead of the rest of the world. Radically ahead. I mean, 7,000 years, you have major religions who, I mean, still in their literature say, you know, even in the New Testament, the Bible, that women should sit in the back of the church and keep their heads covered and their mouths shut, basically. You had major religions that said it was okay to own slaves, that women should be subordinate. And in a eye blink, historically speaking, you know, in the 7,000-year history of civilization, just the last 100 years or so, we've turned these things around. And I think it's just a marvelous thing. We still have a long way to go, long way to go. But, Jerry, thanks for raising that point.
Okay.
Good hearing from you, and I hope you have a wonderful Thanksgiving. Diana in Olympia, Washington. Hey, Diana, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Tom. See, Tom, you know, I'm feeling empowered every day I listen to you. And one thing I've done over the years is I put bumper stickers, but now I'm starting to do this. And it sort of an analogy is that this week it's been really foggy here in Western Washington.
Mm-hmm.
And today it's just a beautiful sunny day. And an analogy is that Congressman Murtha called for a speedy withdrawal. And a week before that I had put a headline in my back window of my car saying, death toll in Iraq reaches 2,000, and then I put get out now in my own little note.
Mm-hmm.
And I think as we're driving along like this week and I have to drive down to Oregon, I'm putting another sign in there, and I think we should put signs in our window and talk like a blowback media to each other.
I agree, Diana. I have a sign in my... Yeah, I have a sign in the window of the back window of our car that says America Stands with Cindy. It's been there for a couple of months, you know, since Cindy Sheehan first started doing that, and it's just in the window, you know.
One other thing, could you get Captain James Yee on your show? I saw him interviewed on TVW yesterday, and I went out and bought his book. He is a very articulate and courageous young man.
He is, and we've had him on the program. It was a month and a half ago or so. Yeah, he's already been on the program.
Okay,
Diana,
thank you
for calling, and keep up the good work. Keep spreading the word. It's great to hear from you. Our number, 1-866-440-THOM, 866-440-8466. Kenny in Baltimore, Maryland. Kenny, we have about a minute left.
Okay, I just got two comments. The first one, when they keep come up with, like, for Russia to hit you thing about Saddam killing all the Kurds.
Right.
And you should have came back with, well, Rami told him the chemicals. Well, Rami should be sitting in jail with him.
Yeah, well, and not just Rami. It was Reagan, basically, who sold them the chemicals to gas the Kurds with. And that's assuming that Saddam actually gassed the Kurds. The CIA report indicates that there's a good question. It might have been the Iranians, that they were essentially in the crossfire between two armies during a horrible war where we were supporting both sides. We were arming Saddam, and we were giving intelligence to Iran.
Another thing on the free trade. Okay, if y'all want free trade, then let's make any country that have to deal with us and want that free trade have to have a minimum wage across the board in their country for their workers.
Yeah.
That would slow a lot of this stuff down.
It would to some extent, Kenny, but, you know, what are you going to do when you have a country where, you know, Honduras, for example, where, you know, $12,000-$13,000 a year, you can live very comfortably. And so with a good minimum wage there where people can actually have a middle-class income, we still can't compete economically. I think we have to go beyond just minimum wage protections and labor protections. But you make a good point. I appreciate the call and great to hear from you. Thank you. Oh, my. Tomorrow, Thanksgiving. And, of course, Mercury's retrograde. So just, you know, be gentle with everybody. The communication is going to be weird. Right? For those of you who believe in that astrology nonsense, not that I do, but it just always seems to be whenever Mercury goes retrograde, weird stuff happens. Anyhow, it's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live coast to coast on radio stations from, well, literally from California to West Virginia, beaming down from outer space on the Sirius satellite radio system, streaming around the planet, ArabAmericaRadio.com, WhiteRoseSociety.org, RadioPower.org, CRNDigital.com. Welcome back to our program. Nell Bernstein is with us, and she is the author of All Alone in the World, Children of the Incarcerated, a frankly unsettling book. Nell, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
I'm so glad to have you with us. Nell, by the way, an award-winning journalist and former Soros Justice Media Fellow at the Open Society Institute of New York. Your articles have appeared in Newsday, Mother Jones, Washington Post, among other publications. This is serious stuff. We have 1 in 33 American children right now has a parent behind bars, 1 in 8 African-American children. What are the societal consequences of that, in broad stroke?
Well, they're, you know, sort of almost overwhelming. The other number I always think about is 1 in 10, because that's how many kids has a parent who's either locked up on parole or on probation today. And most people on parole will go back. So that's how many kids are right on the edge. You know, one thing I discovered in reporting my book was that there's not a quote-unquote social problem that affects children, from poverty, single-parent families, delinquency, homelessness, that's not either attributable to a parent's incarceration or at least directly linked to it.
In other words, incarceration is a social problem in and of itself?
Yeah, it's sort of double-edged. It causes all the problems that you would expect it to cause when millions of kids lose a parent or parents. It also doesn't solve the problem that's driving the prison boom, which is addiction, so it leaves children to struggle with that unaided also.
Right. So an enormous amount of this is being driven by the fact that we're dealing with medical problems, primarily drug problems.
Right.
As if they were criminal problems.
Yeah, and, you know, the number of people behind bars for some kind of drug offense has increased 12-fold over the past quarter century or so. Meanwhile, the number of people using drugs illegally has nearly doubled. So it's clear that we're not solving a very real problem.
So we have an explosion in the industry of building private prisons, and for that matter, state prisons, but private prisons are very profitable right now, doing very well and growing like a weed. And we have an explosion in the industry of crime, of providing drugs to people.
And to the degree that we've talked about this, you know, I think that politically we've talked about it in terms of how it impacts the people behind bars. And what I try to do in the book is show how far beyond those 2.3 million people the effects go, and how many kids who literally did nothing are now paying.
I think most Americans have never thought about, who have never actually, you know, been in this situation or been close to this situation, don't think about what it must be like to be a child who sees their parent being arrested. One in 10 American children has had a parent, has witnessed this. What is that experience like for a child?
Well, actually, it's many more than 1 in 10, because many, many more people are arrested than are ultimately convicted and incarcerated.
Hmm.
And the kids who have experienced it have generally experienced it over and over. And, you know, I'll tell you what made me write this book was a kid I met a number of years ago who told me he had entered foster care when police had come one day. He was 9 years old and taken his mom out of the apartment and left him with his brother, who was an infant. And this kid spent 2 weeks literally alone in this empty apartment trying to change the baby's diaper and cook for the baby. He burned his hand. And I think that kind of indicated to me just how invisible these kids are and how little attention is paid to them.
And that story is not the weird, unusual, you know, exception that proves the rule story. That story is,
well,
relatively...
Yeah, I mean, when I first heard it, I thought, for several years, I kept it with me as this aberrant thing that had happened to this one child, but once I began reporting on this seriously, I kept hearing it. And more recently, I've been hearing it from law enforcement. There's an article just last month in Police Chiefs Magazine, which is the trade magazine, which looks at it from a liability perspective and runs through several of the most egregious cases in which kids were left in harm's way after an arrest.
I have to think, though, that there's also a psychological impact that goes beyond that. I know that, you know, there have been a lot of studies done that show that kids tend to, by and large, have their parents' political views, for example, that children learn by observation, and that if a child sees police behaving toward their parent in a way that they perceive to be harsh or violent or, hey, you're taking my daddy kind of thing, that child is not going to grow up with a positive attitude about police.
Well, and the same is true when it comes to sentencing. One of the families I profile is struggling with the fact that the mother is doing triple life with no possibility of parole for being involved as a very young woman with her husband's cocaine business. And those kids are also struggling to develop morally in the context of her sentence and what they perceive as the unfairness of that. Of course, the opposite is true also when police or judges are fair and consider children, then children are much better able to develop respect for those authorities.
Which is more common?
Well, you know, one of the more interesting pieces of research in the last few years is some research by a guy named Todd Clear, which looks at the neighborhoods most impacted by incarceration.
Mm-hmm.
And he's found that if you take too many people out of a neighborhood, it actually increases crime because it erodes family and community supports and also erodes respect for the law. So it's sort of a tipping point argument. You know, and I have to say, unfortunately, that most kids' experience with law enforcement is not positive.
Yeah, and that's not surprising. So we have two growth industries that have a strong and powerful vested interest in there being more people put in jail. You have the prison industry and all the things that are associated with it. Back in the 70s, I had a friend who started a company selling test your drug kits, and he was a chemist, and he figured out, you know, you put a couple of drops of this chemical in with some cocaine, or, you know, and you can see how strong the coke is, or one for pot, and he was selling these like in High Times magazine, and he was making them out of his house, and, you know, 25 cents worth of chemicals, and he was selling them for $20, and all of a sudden, this was in the early 70s, and then all of a sudden, by the late 70s, you were having communities that were passing these laws that were requiring drug testing, and he turned this thing in. This guy's a multimillionaire now,
right.
and you know, he went legitimate, as it were, stopped selling it through High Times and started selling them to, like, the Transportation Authority, you know, administration or whatever, the DOT, and he's making just a pile of money. I mean, so you've got all these associated industries, from the, you know, the taser people to the drug testing people to the prison people to the police industry, who, if we were to say tomorrow, hey, we're not going to lock up people for drug crimes anymore, we're going to hospitalize them and we're going to deal with them medically, you would have, you know, major chunks of the American economy that would be dislocated. Plus, you've got, you know, the only entrepreneurial opportunity for a lot of people in very poor neighborhoods is to go into the business of selling drugs.
That is all true. I mean, there's definitely political and economic momentum behind the way we do things. But what's interesting is that if you look at public opinion polling over the past decade or so, there's been a pretty radical shift. The public has moved away from wanting to deal with drugs through incarceration, moved away from wanting to pay for it at the expense of things like education and health care, and is open to a much broader range of responses to crime. The politicians just haven't caught up.
Yeah, I was going to say the public may be there, but I don't see any evidence that, you know, I mean, occasionally you'll have somebody questioning the Rockefeller drug laws, that kind of mentality, but it seems to be the exception rather than the rule.
But I'll tell you, since I've been going around and talking about this book, there's not a room I've entered where someone hasn't come up to me afterwards. Often it's the engineer of the radio show, and told me that this has touched their family.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the president has a niece who's run up against the drug laws. I think ultimately we're casting the net wide enough that I think that in itself may bring about change.
So Nell Bernstein, author of All Alone in the World, Children of the Incarcerated, a marvelous new book. Nell, first of all, is there a website for your book where people can get information specifically about this or these issues?
You know, the website I would refer people to is for an organization I coordinate called the San Francisco Children of Incarcerated Parents Partnership,
mm-hmm.
and that's sfcipp.org. We organize our work around something we call a Bill of Rights for Children of Incarcerated Parents, and there is also some information about the book at that website.
Okay, sfcipp.org. SFCIPP.org, SFCIPP.org.
Yes.
And what, you know, we have about a minute left. What is the best solution? What should we be working toward?
In a minute, I would say that if we revisited our sentencing laws and looked at them through kids' eyes, our prison population would fall by something like half. We'd be just as safe, if not safer. More kids would have parents, and we'd have some money left over for schools.
And so down the road, our society would be much stronger and healthier.
Down the road or immediately.
Yeah, so revisiting our sentencing laws, are you going as far as, for example, saying let's decriminalize drugs and deal with them as a medical problem?
You know, 5 years ago I would have, but then I talked to too many kids who'd been hurt by their parents' addiction. And they really made it, I would have gone around saying this is nobody's business, this is not a governmental issue, but they really set me straight on that. I think we do need to respond. We just need to respond in a way that is not punitive and that decreases rather than increases.
That's more rational.
Someone will stay addicted.
Interesting. Nell Bernstein, the book All Alone in the World, Children of the Incarcerated. Thanks, Nell, for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
16 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
It doesn't matter what they do. All that matters is my relationship to you.
And welcome back, my friends. Ah, yes, Van Morrison there. Had somebody actually, one time, Van, I used to, back years and years ago, back in the late 60s, I did an all-night progressive rock show. And WVIC, AM and FM, Lansing, Michigan. And used to have Van Morrison's Moon Dance as my theme music. And I love his music. And somebody sent me an email going, Van Morrison, he supported George Bush. I'm like, whoa! And so I mentioned it on the air. And thankfully, some of our listeners said, no, that's an urban myth. He actually did not support George Bush. So I can still play his bumper music. It's welcome back to our program. 22 minutes past the hour. Our telephone number, 866-440-THOM. Tony in Seattle, Washington, some thoughts on our previous guest. Hey, Tony, welcome to the program.
Hey, how you doing? Thanks, Tom.
Sure.
I just think that we need to start treating people medically instead of, throwing them in the penal system and the court system.
Yeah.
Or trying to self-medicate themselves. Granted, if they self-medicate themselves and they hop in a vehicle and, wreck, that's just like, driving under the influence. So, that's fine. But I just want to pose this. What if all of a sudden in America, think of this, everybody, there's no coffee, just none. How would corporate America run that day?
Yeah, you'd have a huge black market and stimulants, I can tell you. I had the police chief of Amsterdam on this program about 2 years ago. And now they have not actually decriminalized drugs in Holland because if they did that, they would get kicked out of the European Union. So what they've done is they've simply decided that they're not going to enforce the laws anymore. And here's the chief of police for the city of Amsterdam, or it might have been the number two guy, but it was one of the top two guys. I'm pretty sure it was the chief. It's been, as I said, it's been 2 years. And my memory is getting old. But in any case, he came on and he said that when they decriminalized, for all practical purposes, pot, that they saw a dramatic reduction in crime. Basically, it broke the back of organized crime.
Yeah, that's
because,
a good point. I
because
mean,
everything became legitimate. And the pot shops, I mean, we had Christmas of 2001, right after 9/11, we flew over to Amsterdam for that Christmas because they were giving airfares away. I mean, we stayed in a $400 a night Marriott hotel across from the Rijksmuseum for $99.
Wow.
And I was able to fly free on miles that I had that I would have been able to use for a flight to Cincinnati. And United was saying you can go to Europe on these miles because nobody would get on an airplane. I mean, this was, weeks after or a month after 9/11. And so we took our kids, in fact, to Amsterdam, and who are all grown up adults. And we'd go to this fancy restaurant right across the street from the Rijksmuseum. 5-star restaurant, white linen tablecloth. You know, this was going to be our big meal, right?
Right.
They come over. They hand us the wine list, my wife and I, and they hand us the pot list.
Wow. Wow.
And it's like there's a list of, you know, which do you want?
You're making me salivate here.
I mean, it was downright strange. Now, I'm not going to tell any more of the story beyond that.
Yeah,
but
I understand.
But it was like, you know, this guy, what this police chief said on this program was that they broke the back of organized crime. And we saw the same thing in England when they said with heroin. That they were going to make it a pharmaceutical that was about 10 cents a dose, and all you had to have was a prescription from your doctor. And what they saw was that heroin addiction, number one, went down because it was no longer being pushed by anybody. There was nobody encouraging people to take it because there was no profit motive in it anymore, number one. And number two, more or less 30% drop in street crime because people weren't sticking people up to get money to buy heroin.
These people are in our society, everybody, and for us to go around acting like locking them up and abusing them, kicking down their doors is somehow erasing the problem is not the case. I mean, you're talking about reducing crime. Reducing crime should be like one of our main priorities, you know. It's just, I don't know, we got to come out of the antiquated, former thinking about drugs and step up to a new type of thinking and try to help people. And some people don't really need help. Some people are okay with it if they could, you know, somehow get a source to it. They don't need to go out and rob and steal. There are people out here that are surviving that are doing drugs around us. That, you know, so
it's just that they have a prescription for them. In most cases. I mean,
okay.
That's the thing. Here, Tony, you say we need to have new thinking about this. What I would say is we need to have old thinking about this.
Okay.
When this country was founded, you know, you read George Washington's diary, and he's going out separating the male from the female pot plants.
Right.
The Constitution and the Declaration of Independence were written on hemp paper.
Yeah, on hemp, that's true.
You know, you could, in 1900 or 1915 in the United States, you could buy Coca-Cola that had cocaine at very, very super low dosage.
George Jefferson cultivated it, if I'm not mistaken.
Thomas Jefferson.
Thomas Jefferson.
Yeah. Actually, Jefferson didn't, but George Washington did, yeah.
Okay.
Thanks, Tom.
You're a splendid audio host, man. You have a good Thanksgiving.
Thanks a lot, Tony. You too. Have a wonderful Thanksgiving. I mean, this is a serious thing. We should go back to the old thinking about drugs. The drugs were not made criminal. You know, we didn't try prohibition in this country until basically the 20s and the 30s. And the prohibition did not work with alcohol, and it's not working with other substances either. And people who get addicted to these things are suffering from a medical problem, and they need medical and psychiatric intervention, not criminal justice system intervention. That kind of intervention, in my opinion, just my own personal opinion, and from what I've seen around the world, that kind of intervention, criminal intervention, criminal justice system intervention, brings a whole brand new set of problems. And a whole new societal ill. And a whole new opportunity for profit. I mean, look at all the money that Joe Kennedy and Al Capone made when alcohol was prohibited during Prohibition. Prohibition creates opportunities for crime. It's very simple. 27 minutes past the hour is the Tom Hartman radio program where reason is our lifestyle choice.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Here's the story of a corporation that has newspapers in every place you go. It also owns a couple cable stations, a movie studio.
Oh, let's see, would that be Time Warner?
And there was another corporation that controlled all access to the internet.
Oh, and might that be AOL?
One day these corporate giants formed a merger.
Yes, welcome back, my friends. Yeah, sifting through your private correspondence. 35 minutes past the hour. The Tom Hartman radio program. The U.S. Justice Department. A lot of hot news here. Hugo Chavez is in the news. We'll get to that in just a second. This breaking. The U.S. Justice Department has sued the state of Missouri. Get this. This is from Reuters. Sued the state of Missouri. A swing state that before the election, everybody was saying, you know, the polls show that Missouri may well go for John Kerry. Nobody knew up until Election Day because all of the polls were showing that Missouri was pretty much split 50-50. It was a swing state. In fact, some of the early polls were suggesting that Missouri was definitely going to go for Kerry. But Bush won it 53-46%, according to the, you know, official registration, or the official numbers at the end of the election. Now we have the U.S. Justice Department has sued, this from Reuters, has sued Missouri, a swing state easily won by President George W. Bush, for voting violations in the 2004 election, including registering more people to vote in some counties than their entire voting age population. The complaint was filed yesterday. It said 29 Missouri counties and election jurisdictions had more people registered to vote than there were actually people of voting age. One Missouri county, for instance, showed voter registrations that amounted to 150% of the true voting age population in that county. Yeah. The Secretary of State, Robin Carnahan, presumably a member of the Carnahan family dynasty in Missouri. You'll recall Mel Carnahan was the former fabulously popular Democratic governor of Missouri, running against John Ashcroft for the United States Senate. Mel Carnahan died in a plane crash, mysterious plane crash. A lot of spooky parallels between that one and the one that killed Paul Wellstone just before the election of 2002. This was in 2000. Died in a plane crash. And our esteemed former attorney general thought he had, Mr. Ashcroft, thought he had it made, and he lost to a dead guy. So George Bush made him attorney general. That's, you know, the Bush administration. If somebody fails miserably, we salute them. We reward them. In any case, the Secretary of State, Robin Carnahan, acknowledged the voting irregularities, but said in a statement that the Justice Department's decision to file suit was costly and unjustified as the state was working to correct its voters' rolls. Yeah, they were working on it. The lawsuit also alleges that some voters were removed from registration lists without notification in violation of the law, while some ineligible voters were not removed. Missouri, Reuters adds, was considered among a number of potential swing states in the 2004 election, but ended up with 53% voting for Bush and 46% going to challenger John Kerry. And it may well be that that margin of error, and I'm telling you, Missouri is just the tip of the iceberg. The same thing was happening in Florida. It was happening in Ohio. It was happening in a number of other swing states. It was certainly happening in New Mexico, that margin of victory, rather, margin of error, the margin of victory may well have been phony Republican registrations and Democratic registrations being bounced off. Keep in mind, there was a company that was outed. The TV station in Las Vegas actually had videotape of them. They were operating up here in the Northwest. They were operating in several states. Turns out that they were paid by the Republican National Committee. And what they were doing, you walk by these public buildings, federal buildings, city hall, whatever, shopping malls, setting up card tables and saying, register to vote here. And thousands and thousands, perhaps tens of thousands, maybe even hundreds of thousands, nobody knows, of people in many states, in many of the swing states across the United States, walked up to those tables and said, oh, I should register to vote. I'll do it right here. And on the vote, and it was the official voter registration form. And on that registration form, and this was a private for-profit corporation doing this, on that voter registration form, in most of the swing states, in most states, you can register as an independent or as unaffiliated, or you can register as a Democrat, or you can register as a Republican. Or in some cases, you can register as a member of the Green Party, the Progressive Party, whatever. And what that registration does is it allows you to vote in that party's primaries. These are states that have what are called closed primaries, where, only Democrats can vote in the Democratic primary, only Republicans can vote in the Republican primary, and it, reduces mischief. So anybody who checked the Democrat box said, yes, I'd like to register as a Democrat, it was learned. After they thought they registered to vote and they walk away, their voter registration card was torn up and thrown away. Whereas anybody who registered Republican, their registration was filed. And we're talking about major operations in a number of states. There was another operation where they would walk up to you and they would say, I wonder if you're interested in signing a petition to decriminalize marijuana. Now, this clearly is something that probably is going to appeal to more Democrats than Republicans. And there were reports that also they were doing this with gay marriage, you know, if not gay marriage, but civil unions. Would you like to sign a petition in favor of civil unions? Again, something that Democrats would be more likely to say, sure. And then they would show them a clipboard, and they would have to fill it in with their name and their address and they'd sign it, thinking that they were signing something in favor of, you know, decriminalizing pot or reducing the penalties or in favor of civil unions. And in fact, what they were doing was they were signing a voter registration card that changed the precinct in which they were supposed to vote. Because the part of the card that defined the precinct was up above the fold and had been folded over, and it was underneath the clip on the clipboard, and they couldn't see it. And so, again, thousands, tens of thousands, maybe even hundreds of thousands of people across the United States who had signed these, thinking they had signed these petitions, had actually re-registered themselves to vote, showed up to vote in the normal polling place where they normally voted and discovered that they couldn't vote there. And they were told, sorry, you know, you're in the wrong place. You got to go across town and stand in line for another 6 hours. In some states, they were allowed to cast provisional ballots if they could prove that they were registered to vote, even if it was in a different place. And to this day in Ohio, there's over 80,000 provisional ballots that have never been opened, that haven't been counted. So we're looking at massive, systemic, widespread voting fraud. This is all separate from the possibility of a machine being hacked. Got an email from somebody a couple of days ago saying, you know, if voting machines are hackable, it was addressed to me. He said, if voting machines are hackable, Tom, would you please go on the air and ask the hackers out there to hack into the voting machines and change the candidate's name to Disney characters so that when the election results are finished, people are going, you know, Brian Williams is going to have to say with a straight face, in California, Donald Duck got 12% of the vote. Mickey Mouse, 22%. I think there's something wrong here. Yeah, I think there's something wrong there. Sounds good. So anyway, that's interesting breaking news, as it were, for the day. The jolly good fellow, our caught you doing something right for the day, goes to Hugo Chavez. Indeed, Venezuela's President Hugo Chavez, controversial political leader, but he seems to be getting a little traction here. The Boston Globe today, editorializing about Hugo Chavez. He is a controversial political leader, they note, but it's difficult to fault his decision to provide low-cost heating oil to nearly 45,000 needy families in Massachusetts. Now, what brought this about? Chavez came to New York a year ago for a U.N. meeting. He came to speak at the U.N. or to be there at the U.N. And he took a tour around New York, and he saw the poverty in New York. And he said, this is terrible. We've got to help these folks out. And keep in mind, Venezuela is the fourth largest importer of oil into the United States. On some days of the week, the third largest. And, you know, I mean, one of our major sources of oil. They have just a pile of oil down there. And so he says, we'll provide this stuff cheap. So U.S. Representative William Delahunt of Massachusetts, using his contacts in Venezuela wisely to help people in his coastal district and throughout the state get through a costly heating season, notes the Boston Globe in an editorial today. This 40% below market prices, he's offering this. As a result of the agreement, Venezuelan-owned Citgo will distribute 9 million gallons of oil via Citizens Energy Corporation to more than 40,000 families in 200-gallon increments. 3 million more will go to nonprofit institutions, the equivalent of a one-tank fill-up. This is a, you know, your home heating oil tank. Will be sold at a steep discount, perhaps $1.40 a gallon. Fuel oil at retail costs $2.30 per gallon. That's pretty impressive. They say one tank full may not seem like much, but combined with federal heating assistance and state aid, it might just get a family through a tough, expensive winter. The major oil companies ought to follow the Venezuelan example as a gesture of goodwill to their hard-pressed customers. Yeah. All right. Something about ice cream melting in strange places. That'll be the day, right? When the oil companies say, oh, yeah, $8 billion, greatest profit in the history of the world, but we think we'll share some of that with the people who are using our products. Somehow I doubt it. 45 minutes past the hour. Yeah.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
If you knew that you would die today, you saw the face of God and love, would you change? Would you change? If you knew that love can't break your heart, when you're down so low, you cannot fall, would you change?
And welcome back, my friends. 9 minutes before the hour.
Would you change?
Tom Hartman here with you. Boy, a lot in the news here. George W. Bush informed of lack of Iraq al-Qaeda ties. The National Journal reporting this, and now it's creeping out all over the world. This is actually the Al Jazeera report, which is basically a clone of the wire service reports and the New York Times report. U.S. President George W. Bush informed 10 days after the 9/11 attacks that there was no proof of ties between Iraq and the al-Qaeda network. The magazine cited government papers as well as former and present Bush administration officials as saying that the president was briefed on September 21, 2001, that the U.S. intelligence community had no evidence linking the Iraqi regime of Saddam Hussein to the 9/11 attacks or the al-Qaeda network. Bush was also informed that the few credible reports of contact between Iraq and al-Qaeda actually involved attempts by Saddam Hussein to establish surveillance over al-Qaeda. According to the National Journal, Saddam believed that al-Qaeda posed a threat to his regime. He was right, by the way. Osama bin Laden got thrown out of Saudi Arabia because he was going to try and invade Iraq. At one point, the analysts say the toppled Iraqi leader considered infiltrating the ranks of al-Qaeda with Iraqi citizens or even Iraqi intelligence agents to learn more about its inner workings. Now, this is just incredible. Now, keep in mind, the intelligence services of the United States, part of the police function of the state, is under the executive branch. It's part of the president's part of government. The legislative branch of government, the House and the Senate, do not have investigative capability. They don't have a police. Well, they have the Senate police. They have the ability to throw a member out. Actually, I'm not even sure if that's... Yeah, it's got to be the legislative branch. They've got to have their own police department just within that little... But they can't do investigations. They don't control the FBI. They don't control the Secret Service. All of that stuff is controlled by the executive branch of government. And so now we find that the executive branch of government, on the 21st of September 2001, this is 10 days after 9/11, is told no relationship between al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein. And the few stories that you have of attempted contacts between the two, they have to do not with al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein trying to get together, Osama and Saddam trying to get together, but with these guys trying to spy on each other. Because they hate each other. They each represent, each one views the other as a threat. And here's where it gets really weird. The highly classified CIA assessment was distributed to President Bush, Vice President Cheney, the president's national security advisor and deputy national security advisor, that would have been Condoleezza Rice and Stephen Hadley, the secretaries and undersecretaries of state and defense, that would have been Colin Powell and Don Rumsfeld and Richard Armitage, and I'm not sure who was the undersecretary of defense at that time, and various other top Bush administration policymakers, according to government documents. Now, it doesn't say any of this was given to the House or the Senate. And, you know, Bush is running around going, they saw the same intelligence I did. Apparently not. And now the Senate Intelligence Committee, the Republican-controlled Senate Intelligence Committee, has asked the White House for the CIA assessment, the presidential daily briefing of September 21, 2001. The Bush administration has refused to turn it over. Now, isn't this a little strange? On the one hand, Bush is saying, they saw the same intelligence I did. And on the other hand, they're saying, sir, we would like to see the same intelligence you saw. And he's saying, no, you can't see it. So he's saying to us, they saw the same intelligence I did and when they voted to go to war. But then when the Senate says, well, we'd like to see that intelligence, Bush says, no. Have we fallen through the rabbit hole? Is up down and left is right and red is black and black is red, and I mean, just meanwhile, 2 minutes. Same time you got Jack Murtha out there saying, "Hey, it's time to draw down the forces." Condi Rice just said the same thing. Condoleezza Rice, quote, "I suspect the American forces are not going to be needed in the numbers that they're there for all that much longer." End quote. Why? I'm telling you, This is the Republican rage about Murtha's proposal is coming because Murtha said what he said before the second week of December when the Republicans were planning to roll this thing out. The Republicans were planning on, you know, it's the old Nixon trick. Use war for political advantage. Nixon did it with Vietnam, and Bush was trying to do it with Iraq, and the Democrats got out ahead of him, and they are just nutso furious. Absolutely furious. Well, it's time for a Berlusconi alert. Silvio Berlusconi, you'll recall, the guy, the small-time crook in Italy who bought a radio station, then bought a TV station, bought another radio station, bought a newspaper, bought a radio network, bought a TV network, bought another radio network, another TV network, finally owned 90% of the media in Italy, and he ran for prime minister. And guess what? He won! Well, today, Italy's justice minister questioned the motives of a Milan prosecutor seeking the extradition of 22 purported CIA agents. Now, get this. The prosecutor in Milan wants the CIA to, you know, he wants these guys extradited. These guys snatched a guy on the streets of Milan on February 17, 2003, took him to Egypt and tortured him. And the Italian prosecutor in Milan is saying, we want to talk to these CIA agents. And so now Berlusconi is saying, this prosecutor, he's a leftist militant and he's anti-American. No, not really. The chief prosecutor of Milan, his name is Milano Minali, later released a statement in support of Spataro, the Justice Minister Robert Caselli and Armando Spatello, the guys who are pursuing this thing, saying, no, sorry, Berlusconi is pumping this thing for politics. This is all part of the CIA's extraordinary rendition program in which terrorism, this from the Associated Press, in which terrorism suspects are transferred to third countries where some are allegedly subject to torture. Yeah. Well, travel safely. Have a wonderful Thanksgiving. I will be back here tomorrow live. All 3 hours we'll be back on the air. So hope to see you. See you again tomorrow. Same time, same place. Have a wonderful time. Be good to your friends and family. Take good care. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.